WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We made it to the end of the week. That means we're kicking off our afternoon with our weekly news recap, where we dig into the biggest stories of the week, including a win for a ballot referendum that aims to fight homelessness.
1 week after a judge ruled that the Bring Home Chicago tax plan was unconstitutional, a state appellate court reverses that decision.
Another ballot win, this one for a former president.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that Donald Trump can stand as a Republican presidential candidate in the Colorado primary.
That ruling means he stays on the Illinois ballot, too. And an update on who holds the power when it comes to city schools.
This November, half the board will be elected by the community, while the other half will be appointed by the mayor.
This week, our panel includes Lee John Greco, government and politics reporter for Crane Chicago Business, WTTW political correspondent Amanda Vinicky, and we've got Tessa Weinberg, city government and politics reporter for WBEZ. We start with a big victory for Mayor Brandon Johnson this week. Votes will be counted in the Bring Chicago Home referendum. There were a lot of legal twists and turns, right, Lee? What's the latest?
This is very confusing. If you're a voter and you've been following it, you're probably wondering, is it going to be on the ballot? Is it going to be? As of right now, Bring Chicago Home will be on the ballot and your votes will be counted. That's because earlier this week, an appellate court judge overturned a Cook County court judge's decision that it shouldn't be on the ballot anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit confusing. Basically, BOMA, the Building Owners Managers Association, had argued that the city shouldn't be able to have this on the ballot because it's an example of log rolling, where you pair something that is a popular measure, being the tax decrease that this ballot measure has, with an unpopular measure, which is tax increase. And so when the appellate court ruled on this, they actually didn't address that log rolling issue directly. But what they did say is that the courts don't have the authority to intervene in the legislative process. So they can't basically interrupt a ballot measure that is then going to go to city council. Something else interesting that they said is, hey, we're just as confused about this Cook County ruling as everyone else was, because the judge, Kathleen Burke, had said, yes, according to what I said in court, this is my opinion. When, Tessa, I think you were in court with me.
She didn't say much.
She didn't say anything. She gave her ruling and then she abruptly left. It was... I'm going to be honest, it was a very strange hearing that day.
What do you think, Tessa?
Yeah, you know, the hearing itself, I'm not a court reporter, but I'd never seen anything like it, where she out loud read the filings for both sides verbatim for hours, even the case citations. And so it was, you know, interesting to see in that ruling where even the appellate court was, you know, we are left wondering, you know, what the reasoning was for this judge's decision. So it was interesting that they also concurred, you know, that was weird.
and this is a major win for progressives, right, Tessa?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the Bring Chicago Home campaign and organizers who for years have wanted to put this issue before voters and, you know, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, this is a big win. And the campaign had been urging voters, continue to vote. You're still going to see it on the ballot, in hopes that a appellate court would reinstate this. And so that, you know, did work. And now that they're going to continue to educate voters and try to get turnout and folks to cast their votes.
Yeah. And neither side stopped during this period. There were still, if you turn on your TV, You certainly saw ads mm-hmm. going both ways on this. That said, I think that this back and forth does leave open some questions. If, for example, there's a really narrow loss by one side or the other, are you going to see them back in court to make allegations in terms of, hey, wait, this was confusing. This could have gone the other way, mm-hmm. but not for the back and forth when early voting was already weeks in. I think that's a degree of confusion. And further, I am no lawyer, but might there be other cases, despite this ruling, because of what they're relying on, saying, mm-hmm. all right, it goes back to the court. Could an attorney thereafter say, all right, we have the answer in terms of what voters want for this referendum, but we don't have the legal response, because while there were questions in the second ruling about the first one, there were also elections attorneys who said that there were a lot of flaws with how the referendum question right. was worded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You think this legal drama, Amanda, over the last few weeks might have an effect on voters' opinions?
I mean, perhaps either way. I think that a lot of voters might be swayed to say, hey, wait, that's a fishy way to not take my input, to bring it for a lawsuit. I'm going to vote for it. Others might have seen the commercials, have seen that there was a legal issue, and be prone to not vote. Maybe at all.
Yeah.
And so what change that it might make for the result, we don't know.
We really yeah. don't know. Well, Lee, you wrote about Michael Casper, who's the attorney representing the real estate interests in this mm-hmm. fight. What else should we know about him?
Yeah, so very interesting guy. He is, you know, one of the masters of Illinois election law. He was Rahm Emanuel's lawyer when he had his residency challenges several years ago when he was going to run for mayor. And he's also known sort of by other lawyers, and also he said this himself. He once referred to himself as Vader during I think it was a 2014 challenge regarding the remap, mm-hmm. which, of course, you know, Madigan wanted control of that. Casper was the longtime top lawyer for Madigan. So he is on the side of the real estate industry in this. He was the one that was, you know, out front along with Michael Delgado making this log rolling argument. And when I interviewed other lawyers, even those who have gone against him in the past, they also said what Amanda was referring to earlier, which is, you know, this was a poorly worded ballot. So Michael Casper might have the upper hand here. Now, again, as I mentioned, in the appellate court's ruling that came out earlier this week, they didn't even address that. So I expect that Casper and the rest of his legal team are going to file an appeal that would go to the Illinois Supreme Court. And, you know, I'll be very interested to see what comes out of that, because he is a very good lawyer and very experienced here.
Well, while Mayor Johnson's been celebrating getting this referendum secured on the ballot, he also announced some changes to his press office, Lee. Fill us in on that.
I don't think any of the reporters here are any stranger to how Mayor Brandon Johnson has been interacting with the press, or at times not.
Or not.
Yeah, I think that's the key.
Yeah, the yeah. lack of transparency is the key here. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, I know the lack of transparency is another story we're going to get to today. But, you know, if you have watched any of these press conferences, there was a press conference that got really testy just a couple weeks ago, where everyone was asking the same two questions about ShotSpotter and about funding for the migrant crisis, and the mayor wouldn't answer it. And we all came out of that press conference saying to each other in City Hall, hey, he really needs somebody, maybe even somebody from D.C., who can just kind of get him on track, get mm-hmm. him to answer a question. And so Joe Calvello, he is the top press guy for Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. Mm-hmm. If you're not familiar with him, he's the only guy in the Senate that wears a hoodie and shorts on the reg.
Okay.
He's also kind of emerged as this progressive rising star. So, you know, maybe a little bit of overlap there with Johnson. Mm-hmm. And so he is supposed to come into the Johnson administration within the next couple of weeks. Meanwhile, Ronnie Reese, who has been press secretary for Johnson since his campaign, is going to be his new comms person. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of, you know, reshuffling the deck chairs, yeah. but also I think finally trying to control the narrative here and hopefully improve their relationship with the press and just overall their right. strategy.
Yeah, and Joe Calvello's coming back home. He grew up here in the West Suburbs and went to Naperville North High School. So it should be interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that lack of transparency, Tessa. So these press staff changes, they come right after journalists and civic leaders have been complaining about that, right? So have City Hall reporters been noticing a failure to communicate under Johnson?
Yeah, you know, I think that press conference was a perfect example of, you know, reporters were interrupting him as he started to go on these winding answers and saying yes or no. We want a straightforward answer.
And how does this compare to previous administrations? Just so we're aware. Like, yeah. Why is this such a stark contrast for press reporters?
There has always been, you know, issues with transparency from the administration. I think that's a perennial, you know, complaint from reporters. But I think also we've been seeing, you know, maybe not just tension with how, you know, the mayor is answering questions from reporters, but even recently with access to City Hall, where, you know, my colleague Mariah Wolfel was reporting on the proposed changes to restrict, you know, where the public could sit, making it, you know, a little more cumbersome for the public to be able to participate and give their input on these meetings. And, you know, we saw the Civic Federation, Better Government Association, League of Women Voters all recently, you know, urge the city council and the mayor to, you know, make City Hall and these meetings more accessible, mm-hmm. whether that's giving the public more time to be able to share their input or just even ensuring basic things like the agenda and what legislation is getting voted on are actually publicly accessible, even sometimes for journalists when there's new revisions of some of the ordinances. You know, sometimes those aren't even online yet, and you have to kind of work your sources to maybe get a copy. But it's really interesting.
Which you shouldn't have to do. Right. Work your sources to get a copy of something that's being voted on. And therein, I think, mm-hmm. lies the issue. I'm always careful when we talk about things because I think you'd be like, oh, poor reporters, just do your job.
Right.
And mm-hmm. the issue here being that you can't when there have been issues with reporters, for example, not being allowed to come in with a backpack that has their laptop in it. I mean, those sort of things. Or FOIA requests, that's Freedom of Information Act requests, that aren't responded to. And therefore, an administration that is supposed to be prided on transparency doesn't respond to them. And you have to go to court to get that. That's when we're talking about, I think it's more than just a back and forth. It's a basic tenets of running an office, let alone an office from an administration that has pledged to be open and where we have talked after the perennial problems that Chicago has with corruption. This is the whole part, right? You need people to be watching and make sure things are on the up and up.
You need an open communication style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say on the FOIA requests, Matt Topic, who's a FOIA lawyer, wrote in Cranes that he has filed nearly 60 FOIAs in the last 6 months. For this administration.
6-0.
6-0,
I wonder how many were responded to.
That's a great question.
Yeah, he wrote about how, I mean, few it has been. In some cases, it seems to be, the question was even, is this just an issue of competency? By flat out not responding,
right.
Which by law you need to do. It spells out how many days that you have in order to send a request, even for asking for an extension.
So, Amanda, another primary ballot issue was resolved this week. Where are we with Donald Trump being on there?
He'll be on the ballot.
He
was never really officially taken off, and this is something that's interesting to me in the sense that with early voting, again, you have sort of limited changes that you can make once that has begun already. Machines are programmed, ballots printed. So he is, however, officially on, and that is because of the U.S. Supreme Court really saying that states cannot have the ability to take off a candidate for this sort of federal office, that would create total patchwork and confusion and chaos. And so that's why President Trump will be on the ballot in Illinois as well as in Colorado.
Yeah.
What the Supreme Court did not rule on is whether the former president should be, as was deemed in Illinois in the final court ruling, an insurrectionist. And that was based off of the Colorado decision that found, yes, because of his role on the January 6th riots at the Capitol, that the former president engaged in trying to undermine the federal government and mm-hmm. therefore should not be allowed to run to lead it.
And that nonprofit group that filed the ballot challenge on behalf of the five Illinois voters, anything that they've said about the Supreme Court's ruling?
I mean, as you would expect, disappointment, right?
Yeah. So we mentioned early voting opened in all of the city's 50 wards this week. So I want to hear what primary races you all are keeping an eye on. I'm going to start with you, Tessa. Democratic Congressman Chuy Garcia is facing a challenge from 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez. What's happening in that race?
Yeah, so this is a race, you know, for the 4th Congressional District, which is a Latino majority district. And, you know, they are both Democrats, but Raymond Lopez is arguably a much more conservative Democrat. I think he's considered one of the most conservative on city council. And he's trying to unseat Chuy Garcia, who is really a progressive powerhouse in Illinois politics, a longtime, you know, politician. Mm-hmm. And they're really, you know, divided on some issues like, for example, Israel versus Gaza and what level of support the U.S. should be giving and whether to call for a ceasefire. But sometimes they have similarities, too, of even though they have different stances when it comes to immigration. They both want to see the Biden administration take more action to provide permanent pathways mm-hmm. for undocumented residents. But it's, you know, it's heating up. They're both pointing fingers at each other when
they
it comes
are.
To who's connected to which corrupt politicians in Illinois. And so it'll be an interesting race to see how that plays out.
And Lopez seems to be a good friend of Fox News.
He has appeared several times in the past.
Even though he's a, quote, deep blue Democrat.
Yes, he calls himself a deep blue Democrat. And he says, you know, it shows his willingness to talk to everybody, to work with both sides, that he says it doesn't matter what party you are, I'm going to go for the most pragmatic solution is how he frames it.
Now, even though Congressman Garcia is a supporter of Biden, now he jumped on Twitter last night. I don't know if you caught that. This was after the president referred to the person who allegedly killed nursing student Lakin Riley as, quote, unquote, an illegal. Mm-hmm. That's not a term that's going to go over well with Garcia.
Yeah, no, he tweeted, you know, as a proud immigrant, I'm extremely disappointed to hear President Biden use the word illegal. Lots of other Democratic, you know, lawmakers quickly, you know, condemn that as dangerous rhetoric.
And Garcia is likely or largely Latino district, mm-hmm. right? Is not going to be in favor of that.
Yeah, definitely immigration is, I think, a top issue in voters' minds there, mm-hmm. definitely a top issue both candidates are talking about. I think it makes sense he stood up, you know, to speak out on that.
What races are you watching, Lee?
As I mentioned earlier, I think Bring Chicago Home is the one to watch for my money, given the legal back and forth here.
Sure.
But also looking at the state's attorney's race, that one has not been as hot, obviously, because now that Kim Fox is out of it, I think so many voters and readers have just kind of checked out.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as sexy anymore. But I think it's heating up a little bit. I just saw this morning that the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce endorsed Burke, and that is not totally surprising. She seems to have more of the conservative, and I don't mean conservative like Republican, but conservative Dem bent in this race versus Clayton Harris, who has been endorsed by Preckwinkle, so has a little bit more of that progressive clout on his side. Mm. But it is interesting. I think policy-wise, there's not a huge difference between them, but watching who is endorsing each of them might be a little bit more telling. And even from the start, Burke has had to, you know, swat away criticism from more progressive Dems that she has support from Republicans.
Right.
So, you know, we'll see how that shakes out.
Interesting. Any other primary races you're keeping an eye on, Amanda?
Yeah, I think it is worthy of mention that Congressman Danny Davis has himself a contest from City Treasurer Melissa Conyers-Irvin, as well as Kenya Collins, who has tried before to oust him. That might be, I guess you don't know how that's going to go ever, but having two opponents versus one generally tends to favor the incumbent. And then there are a handful of state legislative races that are largely decided in the primary. And given that they're not citywide and we don't have limited time, won't mention all of them, but those include the Mary Flowers, who is the longest serving member, I believe, of the General Assembly, certainly the longest serving Black member and Black woman, who is facing an opponent that is actually being propped up by the Illinois House Speaker. So that's really a fascinating race in the internal dynamics there. And then also a big contest for Natalie Toro, who holds the seat that one of Mayor Johnson's top lieutenants left in order to go serve in the mayoral administration.
I think I've seen every possible Natalie Toro commercial.
You and me and everyone else in the city of Chicago.
Time to turn to state politics. Lawmakers were in Springfield this week. Let's start with Chicago's elected school board. What's the latest there, Amanda?
what really ended up happening is that we had a lot of unresolved questions, though it was a 2021 law that moved Chicago to the path of getting an elected school board. What was unresolved then was sort of the mechanics of how that would work out. Now there has been an answer to that, including finalizing the districts that these elected members would represent, and also what that first election would look like. And that, as you just heard, is going to lead to a board that's half appointed, or half plus appointed, I should say, plus half elected. So really what that means is that the mayor is going to keep control, because, or at least majority control of the board. The rest will be elected. And so 10 seats elected from what are essentially larger districts that then come 2026 will be split in half.
So we're clear, when are we going to see the first school board election, and how exactly are our voters going to choose this?
In November. So this is coming up pretty soon. And anybody who wants to run for these seats, and that's part of why the legislature had actually given themselves an extension to decide this by April 1st, and why there was this rush to get it done prior to the primary, because anybody who wants to run for these seats has to collect a whole bunch of signatures. And so in order to do that, the minimum would be 1,000 signatures. That's a tough task to do.
That's a lot.
And so they have to get going in order to make it on that November ballot. And then, as I noted, you're going to have to run in one of these 10 districts. What will then happen is, after the voters have spoken and chosen their representative, the mayor has to choose someone from the essential other half of that district. Well, will eventually be the 20. So he will have to choose people from 10 particular areas in the city, not from everywhere, with the exception of citywide, will be able to choose the board president.
Okay, goodness. What was the feeling generally, though, among senators about this hybrid plan?
Republicans largely voted against it, in part because they said that the districts were gerrymandered. But also, I think just there was frustration with how this came to pass on the part of both Republicans as well as members of the public who were active in saying that this seems as if it is just a gift to the CTU. The notion being that the Chicago Teachers Union, where, of course, Mayor Johnson previously served as an organizer, spent a lot of money to get him elected, sort of drained the coffers of the union, and so wouldn't have the money to be able to run 20 different candidates, and don't necessarily need to have as many candidates now that their mayor, their choice for mayor, is in City Hall and gets to make the appointment. So,
the CTU supports this plan, begrudging frustration.
The CTU does support this plan after having for years called for an immediate move to an all-elected school board and being very frustrated with, when it was Mayor Lightfoot, the call for a hybrid plan.
Right.
You do have, I should add, that backers of this route, and that did not, by the way, include the Senate sponsor, Senate President John Cullerton, who sort of begrudgingly moved it forward when it became clear that the House was on par with the CTU and the Johnson administration. They say that this is just going to make it this late hour for a more orderly transition.
So originally the CTU and Johnson fought for a fully elected school board. Tessa and Lee, I mean, what's coming to mind for you on why they could have changed their minds here?
When I was sorting through this in my own mind, the confusion about it, the first thing that I thought of was, do you guys remember that episode of Veep, Nevada? Where first the one side wants to count the vote and the other side wants to stop the count, and then they flip.
Oh my gosh.
That's essentially what happened here, basically, is that the CTU pushed for this for many, many years. And then as soon as they got their guy in office, it's actually, hold the phone on this fully elected thing. We might actually want the mayor to appoint at least half the school board.
Yeah, and this keeps Johnson in control of the board until like 2027, right, Tessa?
Yeah, I believe so. And we'll kind of see how things, you know, play out once now, you know, that this plays through the process. And I'm really curious to see how these elections go, you know, what that looks like, of which kinds of candidates end up jumping in, you know, who's going to be backing them. And there has been criticism from some folks saying CTU wanted this to be fully elected and now we're not. So I think it'll be interesting to see, how this adds to the November election.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Now, what other issues, Amanda, have you been hearing lawmakers talk about in Springfield this week?
This is sort of the anything and everything time in Springfield. The session is really fairly in its early stages. In part, that's because they're more focused on, oh, wait, that primary election that is coming up. So you haven't had a particularly robust negotiations just yet. This is, again, anything and everything. Advancing legislation that would protect Illinois wetlands. You have legislation that has been introduced from Republicans that they say wants to make more transparent what the state is doing and spending on the migrant situation. Really, this is, you know, pick an issue and there is going to be a bill about it. One advancing to the governor's desk right now, mm-hmm. dealing with regulation of pawnbrokers. So really, anything and everything at this point, because you haven't gotten into the nitty gritty of yeah. the really tough stuff, particularly, of course, the budget.
So President Biden targeted junk fees in last night's State of the Union, but Illinois lawmakers already have legislation on this, right, Lee?
Well, actually, in a sense, the Illinois legislation is following what is happening at the federal level.
But before you get into that, why don't you tell us what junk fees are?
Yeah.
Because I feel like I might have lost some people.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, probably everyone listening to this has come across a junk fee if you've tried to buy concert tickets, book a hotel, a number of other services, you know.
The fees that you swear at, basically.
Yes, exactly. What is this?
I had this recently. I actually was going to buy concert tickets in Chicago. I was ready. Oh, this seems like a good price. And then all of a sudden I get to the checkout and suddenly that went from a $35 ticket to, you know, $70 ticket.
Yep.
And I said no, because I didn't know that all these fees at the end were coming and you don't know what they're for exactly. And it's not, to be clear, junk fees are different than taxes at the end. You know, this is not like a hotel tax or something that you find at the end. These mm-hmm. are these sort of vague fees that you don't know why they're adding those on.
Right.
And so what the Biden administration has been doing is through the Federal Trade Commission, they had a proposal in October that they wouldn't stop companies from adding these junk fees. But basically what they would do is that they would advertise them ahead of time so that you could accurately compare prices. So you could say, hey, I'm looking at this hotel and it costs this much with the junk fees included versus this one, rather right. than getting to the very end of it. And so what the Illinois lawmakers are saying is, hey, we're not going to wait on the federal government to do this, because whether this goes through rule at the FTC or there's also some legislation in Congress that's brewing on this as well, they know that things in Congress take a while and things take a while to move through federal bureaucracy.
Right.
So this bill that's proposed by Senator Omar Aquino and Representative Bob Morgan in the Illinois General Assembly would prohibit these hidden and misleading fees. Again, not getting rid of them,
right.
just putting them up front. And there's already been a couple other states that have done this or are looking at this. In California, they signed a bill last year banning these junk fees. And now Virginia and PA are also looking at the same thing. So, you know, we'll see what happens. This seems popular among regular people. But mm-hmm. again, once lobbyists get involved,
that's a whole other story.
Oh, no.
You know, I'll add, you mentioned Representative Morgan. I actually just interviewed him yesterday for a story on legislation that would ban guns at polling places. So something interesting that I had been unaware of, that Illinois, despite so much robust gun control measures, is not among the states that currently have that. There are about a dozen that do, and this is proliferating across the nation, measures that at least debating doing just that. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of polling places where guns are banned by virtue of what their day jobs,
yeah.
let's say. So thinking things like schools and government buildings, even those who have a valid concealed carry license cannot take a firearm into any government building. But when you have polling places that are going to be popping up and other structures where it is just fine, this is a measure that is very much opposed, of course, by State Rifle Association and other gun yeah. rights activists who say, hey, don't make us into being dangerous people. But that advocates say something that needs to be done as increasingly increasingly there are security threats levied against election workers.
Yeah. Well, we know that in his State of the State recently, Governor Pritzker introduced this proposal to eliminate the 1% grocery tax, Amanda. Have you been hearing any rumblings from lawmakers on this?
You know, I got to say, this was a brilliant strategic move by Governor Pritzker because it's not taking any cut from the budget that he needs to pass. This is money, the 1% tax on most groceries funds and goes to local governments. So their budgets are the ones that will take the hit, but he gets to look like the great guy for saying that he's doing away with a regressive tax, and who of course wants to pay anything more, least of all on something that we all buy. No matter who you are spending money at some point on unprepared food,
yes,
on groceries. So, and it's just 1%. And further is sort of a political stroke here. The governor says that he wants to make it so that if local governments choose, they could impose their own grocery tax. So further, while you have government, the local municipalities that are complaining what this is going to do to them, that it would require that they either raise taxes in some capacity or cut back their services in some capacity. He's saying you can do it, but then of course it would be their political liability locally. It would be a hit to government's finances, according to what municipalities, I believe, mostly right. self-reported.
But now they get to be the bad guys.
$80 million to the city of Chicago, for example, $1 million to budgets of Batavia and Highland Park, and $2.5 million hit to something like Orland Park.
I was wondering, Amanda, when I was reading your story, to your point about, you know, the cities would have to be the bad guy. Do you feel like this is a trend that Pritzker is doing, where I feel like whether it's this or the migrant crisis, he comes out, he gets to be
passes
the hero,
the buck.
And he just throws these cities under the bus.
I think that that is what you would have a quality political operation, whether it is wise for the state going forward, not my fight to fight, or for municipalities. But yeah, I mean, it is most certainly calculated.
Yeah.
I think that when you get to the migrant crisis, Lee, that's a very good point. There has been so much finger pointing, and some of that is strategic in terms of who has to wear the jacket for faults. And some of that is, I think, just there have been some failures and needing to point that out.
Well, a former Democratic governor is teaming up with a Republican lawmaker on ethics issues. I want to play a little bit of what Pat Quinn had to say.
I think it's very, very important that now that the former speaker is not here with us anymore, there be a new day. Let's let some fresh air into the opportunity to have a real debate.
Give us the nuts and bolts here, Amanda, of this Republican-sponsored ethics amendment.
So you might hear in other states that there are voters making choices on various referenda. You don't have that happening very often in Illinois because it is quite difficult for a citizens' initiative to make it on the ballot. That is what this measure that is now sponsored by former Democratic Governor Pat Quinn, joining with Republican Ryan Spain, who wants to pass this, would do. It would make it so that, let's say, you, Sasha Ann, wanted to bring forward a measure that would put more ethics restrictions on state legislators.
Okay.
Whether that be something like saying that they can't immediately go around and serve as lobbyists, saying that they need to declare more of their conflicts of interest before voting on legislation. Right now, that's something that you could not do. This is an effort that would allow citizens' initiatives to be put on the ballot for further restrictions on Illinois lawmakers. So I think right there in how confusing this is goes to why you aren't seeing really an uprising of support in part. And also, it would take 3/5 of the General Assembly to approve this change that would even put something like this on the ballot. So it has a whole lot of steps. Governor Pat Quinn, this is sort of strange. Yes, he served as governor, but he does not have a whole lot of friends in the General Assembly. And I'm not sure he made any within his party by joining with a Republican. And there is sort of a forever reticence on the part of lawmakers to do anything that would A, take away their control, and B, require that they be under any sort of additional ethics regulations. Yeah. So this has quite a way to go.
Any thoughts here, Tessa? I mean, could this amendment change how politics is played here in Illinois?
I think so. You know, previously, before I started covering City Hall here in Chicago, I covered Missouri state government, and that's a state where ballot initiatives are a huge part of how citizens push forward things that they support that are popular. In Missouri, it's how Medicaid was expanded. It's how marijuana was legalized. Right now, there's a push to restore abortion rights following the fall of Roe v. Wade. So it's a way that in Missouri, you know, citizens have a lot more say. You know, things that maybe you wouldn't think would be, you know, Republican lawmakers who control the state government there would pass, but if it's popular with citizens, it is one way. But it can be, you know, a double-edged sword. There was a, you know, ethics reform and redistricting reform package that voters in Missouri had passed, and then a couple of years later, they actually reversed it. And it was something where, you know, some folks were saying it was kind of a misleading campaign and voters didn't know what they were doing when they did that. And so, yeah, there's
one
a lot
of the drawbacks there.
Yeah, a lot of politics that happened with that too.
Before we take a pause, Amanda, putting you back in the hot seat, because speaking of ethics, this would not be the weekly news recap on Reset if we didn't cover a scandal involving a local politician. Am I right? So this time it is former longtime Democratic State Senator Terry Link. What's going on with him?
Well, so Link is not actually going to serve any prison time, and that is because he cooperated to help the feds catch some other bad actors, including a former Democrat who has served in the Illinois House, and that's Luis Arroyo, who is currently in prison. He and James Weiss, who is actually the son-in-law of Berrios, they both are serving prison time. They They had tried to bribe Link, not knowing that he was cooperating with the feds, for trying to get Link to help pass legislation that would benefit Weiss's company. This has to do with these sort of gambling machines. And so Link, again, the long and short of it is that he won't be serving any sort of prison time because of that cooperation. What he's accused of is things not really related to do super hard with his state office, that he had used some of the money in his campaign fund for personal use, and also that he didn't declare all of his income on his personal income taxes. So there you go.
I just have a question on this. Between Terry Link and Danny Solis, is the new rule in Illinois just do crimes, wear a wire, and you can get away with it? Because, like, I'll do that. That sounds fine.
I mean, you know, I think it is. I imagine
be
that
careful what you admit to me.
Well, no, but I mean, how rare it is for politicians to turn on folks. And I think you really saw that happening with Danny Solis and sort of how members of the city council were like, wait, he did what?
Yeah.
That was perceived as the most wrong, even more so than what Burke did. In Link's case, I don't think that was so. It didn't seem as if he had a very close relationship with Luis Arroyo that he was burning. And so a different situation in a whole lot of ways.
Reproductive rights were in the spotlight at last night's State of the Union. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, the Democrat from Illinois, is leading the fight to protect access to IVF and invited a local infertility specialist to sit with her at last night's speech. Lee, get us up to speed on her legislation.
Senator Duckworth herself has also noted her own journey with IVF, credits it, you
That's
know,
right.
for her own children. So that plays a major part in this bill. But basically, after the Alabama court decision a few weeks ago, Senator Duckworth introduced this bill that would protect those seeking IVF or anything that is what's called assisted reproductive technology. They call it ART for short. And it would also protect the providers, so doctors and insurers. Now, of course, as everything goes in Congress, it has been very difficult to protect reproductive health, you know, to get abortion codified because Republicans will throw up roadblocks to it. And that's what happened earlier this week. You had Senator Nina Hyde-Smith. She's a Republican from Mississippi, and she objected to suspension of normal Senate rules to adopt the bill. And that's just a fancy way of saying, you know, she threw up a roadblock.
Governor Pritzker's been making it clear that IVF is protected here in our state. Amanda, you wrote a story this week about Illinois' Reproductive Health Act, TGIF. What is wrong with me today? But the Reproductive Health
Act... You're doing great.
Thanks. You're doing a good job, sweetie. But that Act, I think it's something that a lot of us are not familiar with. So can you just talk us through it?
Yeah, I took a deep dive sort of into the governor continually was asked, given what happened in Alabama, what about here? And said, we protect it. But how was sort of the question. And that is through a law, as you noted, the RHA for short, that originally passed before Dobbs. And then Illinois went back and changed and really clarified after that ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. So this really does protect a individual's reproductive choices, whatever they may be. Mm-hmm. The law as currently stands, but amended again post the Dobbs decision, explicitly protects what happens, first of all, mm-hmm. to potential embryos and who gets control of it, lays it out in the state act of parentage, and then also clarifies that there is to be no infringement on any form of art, be it IVF or otherwise. And so really what that is to say is that you aren't going to be able to have a ruling as there was in Alabama from the Illinois Supreme Court because it is enshrined in law. And that is, I will add, that's sort of the basic understanding. There are various measures before the state legislature right now that would expand IVF protections, be it to require that certain insurers cover egg freezing for anybody who chooses to do that, yeah. or for lifting a current cap of 4 rounds of IVF cycles. That's something that advanced out of committee just the other day.
Interesting. Well, Tessa, I want to turn to you for an update on Chicago's stadium drama, because mm-hmm. what is going on? The Bears and White Sox, they're reportedly teaming up. They're doing a financial partnership to possibly move forward with both of their plans for new stadiums.
Yeah, so our colleague Fran Spielman at the Sun-Times, you know, she had a great story where she spoke with Kurt Bailey, president of Related Midwest, which oversees that 62-acre site known as the 78 where the White Sox ballpark would be built. And he says he's been in talks with both the White Sox and the Bears, who both want new stadiums, and trying to have some kind of financing, you know, plan and partnership so both of these could get built at the same time. He pitches this as, you know, really exciting, you know, development and the financing plan. It would consist of bonds that are backed by a hotel tax, sales tax district, and then tax increment financing dollars. And they also say, you know, this would be really kind of an anchor development for this vacant land. And there'd be lots of private investment as well with apartments and hotel and restaurants.
Sounds fancy.
Yeah, it would be this really big, you know, new addition. But it's something that, you know, Governor J.B. Pritzker has, you know, indicated he's, you know, maybe hesitant to be giving public subsidies to a new stadium unless there's going to be long-term really benefits for taxpayers. And Mayor Brandon Johnson signaled maybe a little bit more openness of things on the table, but also reiterating of, you know, this needs to benefit residents and we're not going to just throw these
sure.
dollars.
Yeah. Lee, let's look at some other development news real quick here. Mayor Johnson's doubling down on downtown, specifically LaSalle Street. So what are the details there?
Yeah. And LaSalle Street, of course, if you've been down there recently, it definitely needs it.
You probably haven't.
Because of this fact.
To that point, yes. It's this ongoing cycle.
But you will when?
You will when it looks like the Johnson administration is committing to this idea that came up from the Lightfoot administration, which is LaSalle Street Reimagined. That was this plan that Lightfoot announced in September of 2022, where these buildings that have really been hit hard by the pandemic, of course, LaSalle Street, you know, was once Chicago's Wall Street, essentially. Mm-hmm. And since COVID, folks just aren't going down there every single day the way we used to see that. So the plan initially was to take a lot of those office buildings and convert them into residential or convert them into some other use where people would like to go down there.
And it's a good time because it comes on the heels of the retail vacancy rate in the Loop topping 30% for the first time.
Yes. And that has been increasing for the fourth year in a row now. So it went from 28.3% in 2022 to over 30% now. And that's more than double the pre-pandemic rate. So in 2019, it was 14.9%.
That's a big jump.
It's a huge jump. The Loop is really struggling. If you've been on State Street, you know, I think the Sun-Times had a story about Macy's a few weeks ago. It's very desolate. So Johnson administration expecting to announce more on those specific programs for LaSalle Street Reimagined this spring. And then on top of that, he threw, you know, a couple $100,000 to several other projects, which mm-hmm. I assume you were going to ask me about after.
Yeah, the Border Trade Museum.
Yeah.
Being one of them.
Yeah. So I guess if you are interested in learning more about traitors, if that's your thing. The Johnson administration gave $250,000 for this new CBOT.
Like, now you can.
Now you can. So not yet clear what kind of artifacts we're going to see in there. My colleague Danny Ecker reported on this, but they are going to start doing that. They also gave some money to Ceres Cafe, which is, you know, a Chicago institution. So let's make sure that all Chicago's love that we have a good place to drink on LaSalle Street.
Yeah, because part of the goal here, of course, as we've indicated, is they want to give visitors a reason to come down there.
Exactly.
Come down to LaSalle Street.
Other than going to the office, which they're not doing.
Other than going to work. Right, which they're not even doing that. So, you know me. I try to end things on a positive note here on the recap whenever possible. Doesn't seem at all, you know, very possible these days. But I want to give a shout out today, folks, to a CTA driver named Anastasios Adamopoulos and his passenger, Chris Campbell. Now, at about 2 a.m. on Monday, they saw flames coming out of two houses during the bus's route in the South Shore neighborhood. And the two of them got out of the bus, began knocking on the doors, and they woke up the residents, who all made it out safely.
Wow. That's
amazing.
Awesome.
That's incredible. Awesome.
What a huge thank you to both of them. Like, amazing, heroic efforts.
Step forward, do something right.
Do something right.
Back.
Yeah.
I love everything about that story. It's a municipal worker with a Greek name in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's got it all.
It's the perfect story. And one
appreciate
more.
That this bus driver's driving at 2 a.m. anyway.
Yes.
For whoever has
that
need to get home safe, to get to work, what have you.
One more quick shout out. This one to the CSO, Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They scored one of their largest donations in history, $21 million from the Negoni Foundation. So congrats to the CSO.
Scored was on purpose, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Symbols.
Shout out to Andrea Guffman, our producer. And that is it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Lee John Greco, Amanda Vinicky, and Tessa Weinberg. Happy International Women's Day.
You too. Oh, yeah. Hey.
Happy Women's Day.
Hey.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If you're still listening, that means you really can't get enough Reset. And if that's true, well, consider signing up for our daily newsletter. Every weekday morning at 10:30, we offer news explainers, Chicago culture, and recommendations on things to do around our city and region. You can sign up for that at wbez.org/resetnews. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.